Okay, go ahead, Don.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Burkhart?
Here.
Representative Connolly?
Here.
Representative Greer?
Here.
Representative Moniz?
Here.
Representative Nicholas?
Here.
Representative Stubson?
He's here. Excuse, just went to get his computer.
Senator Burns?
Here.
Senator Hastert?
Here.
Senator Perkins?
He's excused, too. He's in a meeting.
Senator Wasberger?
Here.
Chairman Ross?
He's also on that same meeting.
And he'll Chairman Harshman?
Here.
You have a quorum.
Okay, thank you. Okay, first up, talking about early childhood programs, I think if all of you'd like to take a seat, I think at one time, community college and DFS and Workforce Services. Okay, Representative Connolly asked this call for this callback of these three agencies, and Representative Connolly, you want to lead this off then?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, and thank you for being here, and especially on such short notice. When we were going through the markup and then the round robin, several millions of dollars in early childhood education funding was cut, and I'd like for us to revisit it. And honestly, it's great to have the three of you, four of you, sitting at the table together, three agencies, to talk about what you're doing both individually and collectively, and so that we can hopefully rethink those cuts that we made. And so I'd appreciate hearing from each of you about, I think it's why quality counts, the DFS $750,000 matching program, and then the Community College Commission being responsible for the family literacy programs.
Let's start with Department of Family Services then. And let's just give us a rundown, history lane, the actions of this committee and the program and how we changed it.
Mr. Chairman, Steve Corsi, Department of Family Services. You said let's start with Family Services.
Why don't you just detail, just review for the people here and people listening, the program, the changes JAC made to it?
Okay. So, it'll be kind of an overview, Mr. Chairman, because I'm not exactly sure what you're after, but, right now there is it 750, Nick? 740? That's what I thought. There's $740,000 that the legislature appropriated during this current biennium for what we call early childhood program grants. We put those out to, I believe it's 15 communities currently across the state. Toby Cates from Workforce Services can probably provide you a better history. But as I recall, I'll take a shot at it. Because I think I have the gist. As I recall, this was started about probably 3 years ago, maybe even a little bit before that, with the legislature asking a number of departments to work together on early childhood funding and programs across the state, and we've done that. The Department of Workforce Services, the Wyoming Department of Education, Department of Family Services and even the Health Department to some extent have worked on early childhood programs together along with many local communities and municipalities and nonprofit organizations across the state. At one point there was, I believe, a recommendation to the legislature, or maybe it was even from the legislature, to establish an office of early childhood. The legislature in its wisdom, and I mean that sincerely, the legislature in its wisdom said at that time, which was about 2.5 years ago, I think, said we don't want to do that for a number of different reasons, not the least of which I think was economic. But they came back, or you came back, and said, but what we are going to do is make an appropriation for $740,000. $665,000 of that, I believe, is for programs, and I believe another, whatever the difference is that $65,000, Nick? $75,000. $75,000 of that is for administration.
Director, did you say that Toby or somebody was, okay. Can you just, any other, I mean, give us the exact history when we started funding this and then kind of how you got the 15 communities. Can you give us a little more history and then?
Hang on just a second, Toby. Mr. Chairman, if it's okay, I do want to remind the.
And the reason I'm pushing is you got about 10 minutes each for each agency.
Well, I'm about done.
Okay.
So I do want to remind the committee, Mr. Chairman, that we provided this document to you, should have been two or three weeks ago. You should also have another one this morning. And this document outlines the efforts of each of the communities across the state and what they're doing with that. I also want to tell you that it's my understanding that the JAC has cut, or is proposing to cut that $740,000. Certainly that's not our desire in the department. However, at the same time, if you choose to do that, we'll live with that and we'll adapt accordingly. Toby?
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Toby Cates with Wyoming Department of Workforce Services. We put together a document that I think is really going to help you.
Yeah, we can. Yeah, thank you. These mics were just, it's not like the old Capitol. Thank you.
I'll talk really loud.
Thank you.
We provided a document for you that the State Advisory Committee put together, which was a combination of the four agencies, Health, Ed, Workforce Services, and DFS that have been working on. It starts with Wyoming Early Childhood. The first page is Wyoming Department of Education, January 2016, in blue.
Okay, got it.
So if you flip, the second page is Family Services in orange.
Okay.
If you go to the bottom, the Early Child Community Partnership Grants, that's what Director Corsi was speaking to that we passed 2 years ago, and that was a combination of efforts. Over the last 10 or 15 years, we've been really working to increase the quality of early childhood in the state of Wyoming. It started with the Y Quality Counts program that I'll speak to in a minute, but we got to a place where we decided really the state should not be directing what happens with early childhood in our communities. And this was the program that came together that said, how can we partner state, fed, and the locals for the locals to be able to decide how do they address quality within their communities and provide early childhood education? So there were 14 community grantees. We invested $262,369 in matching and in-kind dollars in the community grant work. Hosted 80 family activities or events that reached 3,952 children and 3,000 adults. 1,832 books were given away. We disseminated 592 different education. We're up to 15 grants. So fluid moving numbers. We've hosted 31 trainings that reached 450 early care and education providers. So that's what we were able to accomplish with those early childhood community partnership grants that were placed in Department of Family Services. So then, I'll stop there and let you.
How about the, just a quick question on your page. I really appreciate the pulling the hand up. Federal funding and state funding, child care development block grants. I mean, as decision is.
Mr. Chairman, I want to point out also, as a supplement to what Toby just testified to, one example of the work of these 15 programs across the state is Amy Reddy and her program out in Hot Springs, Thermopolis. I just want the committee to understand the impact of these grants. The last I knew, there were 229 eligible preschool children in the Thermopolis area, and Amy and her team had reached 210 of 229. That's massive. That is massive when we're talking about kindergarten readiness. Mr. Chairman, Toby's going to talk about I've lost track of what I wanted to say. I've got some notes about the impact on the federal funds, potentially for the Child Care Development Block Grant. We do have to be careful, we being the legislature and state government, we are going to have to be very careful about reductions in this area because the Y quality counts over at DWS ties directly to the Child Care Development Block grant. We DFS use Y quality counts at DWS as our quality rating system. And if we don't have a quality rating system, federal funds can be impacted. We also, at DFS, we're also required to maintain the Early Childhood State Advisory Council, which we do with existing resources. That's another federal mandate that if we don't keep that in place, that can also affect our child care development block grants. Toby?
So this, just to remind us all, so this was the compromise budget amendment 2 years ago, because it was about 1.5 million, and then it was zero in one of the other, in one of the bodies, and this is where we met kind of in the middle to, okay, and so there wasn't any kind of, I guess, was there a thought at that time that this is kind of a one-time batch of money to go out and form these partnerships and get them off the ground?
Mr. Chairman, I was not aware that it was either one-time money or continuing money. I just was not aware one way or the other.
Right. Okay. Any Representative Conley?
Here before we go on, Toby, the good chairman's comment was the comment that was heard on the committee that this was one-time money and it should be over with. Can you speak to that a little bit about kind of the thoughts regarding continuation or not?
Mr. Chairman, when we look at early childhood, it's a continuum, right? Children are born, and then they go through K through 12. To the question about whether this is duplication of funds, it's absolutely not. And the reason I can say that is because there's a variety of different programs, and each program is targeted to take care of a specific population, whether it's what happens with a mother and child at birth, to what happens to that child that has a developmental disability or the at-risk youth. And so each of these funds are very specifically targeted. The community partnerships was really a way for the state to invest state dollars into the overall early childhood system. Without a system, you're going to have an opportunity for us to duplicate efforts. But because of the way we set up the community block grants, and with Y quality counts, that really is providing the mechanism for us to have a system to work across all of our entities to ensure that we're not duplicating, that we're filling the holes with the best of our abilities, and that we really are getting children prepared for kindergarten. Because kindergarten readiness, third grade reading scores, we know, are what's a clear marker of what's going to happen through their life, through K through 12. So, Representative Connolly, if I answered your question, it really does provide the foundation for a system in the state that we need. And I think to piggyback on what Director Corsi was saying, the feds give us quite a bit of money, as you can see, to help support our early childhood systems within the state. We need to have some assurances to them that we are working together holistically and that we have the measures in place that they're looking for so that we can answer at the end of the day that their funds are doing what they want it to do. We've used these funds in that way to ensure that that's happening.
So, Toby, how is this different, though, than the Y quality counts? I mean, it's really about training and the providers, really. I mean, you give away some books and you did those things you talked about, but really it's about kind of getting the adults on track to take care of the little guys.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And I think how you can delineate between the community partnership grants, and if you flip the page twice and go to the green, sorry that there's no page numbers, to what we do with Y quality counts. So in order to get children ready for school, it takes a combination of we've got to have our schools prepared to welcome those children and to be able to educate them when they're ready to learn. The parents have to understand their role, and we also have to have the early childhood providers understanding what's going on. And keep in mind, there's multiple ways that children are being cared for today, many of which are family, friend, and neighbor. So we've got a lot of education to do to reach the families to say what is quality child care and how can we get children ready to learn for kindergarten readiness. And so Y quality counts focuses specifically at the trainer or the early childhood provider that's in a licensed child care facility. How can we get them scholarship dollars so that they can go through the community colleges to receive the training they need to provide that care? We also use part of Y Quality Counts to educate our parents on what we're doing in the child care system with those child care centers, so parents can better be educated on how to choose the best opportunity for their children to be kindergarten ready. The community partnership grants really focus and give the communities the ability to come together and say, do we have the system in our community, and are we doing what we need, and are we educating all the folks across the spectrum so that we can ensure that our children are entering our K-12 system ready to learn? So I know it seems like there's duplication, but they really do piggyback nicely, and it's a marrying of these funds in a way that supports what we need to do.
Services, we've got Wyoming Community College. Dr. Rose, maybe talk about your program, how you come to administer this program, and a little history.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I went through briefly when we had our hearing that the commission inherited the program a number of years ago as a consequence of the Even Start program, which was part of a prior Department of Education program that agreed to assume from Department of Workforce Services. The federal funding for that program was eliminated, and we had by then 8 centers operating, and so we came to the legislature and requested continuing funding to sustain those programs with the state general fund, which we have been successful in thus far. The one thing I would say about our program that I think is somewhat unique to the others that have been described is that ours is a partnership with adult education, and it actually mandates that parents and students participate together. There is a component that requires children and parents to read together, and so there's a very significant adult education component. And the thing we know about early childhood is that there's still a great deal of responsibility and ultimate success in early childhood development that relies on parents. And when you have parents that are constrained by economic resources and their own educational levels, we know that the programs we offer provide a sort of unique response because it couples the parents with the children. The children are all in licensed child care facilities that provide early childhood education at the same time the parents are receiving adult education to enhance their own educational skills, and ultimately the data we have demonstrate that the children in these programs are significantly more successful in later life. In fact, we have data from some of our older programs that have followed children all the way through high school, and their graduation rates are well above our state average. We know that's a consequence of the coupling of parents and children together in an educational experience. So the data I've provided you, the one sheet, provides you some statistical data with respect to the current operations, and Mr. Chairman, I would be open to questions. The thing I guess I would say is we do not, our programs don't overlap with other programs such as Head Start and those kind of things. We actually do, some of our clients actually participate in both, but our clients don't directly, subsidize, the programs that we are administering, those 8 family literacy programs, with federal funding. So it's totally reliant upon state funds.
Okay, so how long is a family in your program? I mean, is it a year-long program?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not precisely sure of the actual time, but it's normally about a year because the parents are the ones that are the determinants. We do take children from infancy basically until they're ready for school. So you have a fairly broad spectrum of age groups, but the parents are the ones that really, once they've achieved a high school equivalency and are prepared to pursue post-secondary education, then oftentimes their tenure with the literacy centers moves toward post-secondary education and more conventional early childhood education.
Okay, so when did the, Dr. Rose, when did the federal, when did we start to even start with federal dollars? What year did we start that? How long has that been?
Mr. Chairman, I believe Even Start was a component from the very inception of No Child Left Behind, and that of course occurred in 2002. So it was an existing federal program that was basically coupled with our own programs and existed for some time, as I said, within the Department of Workforce Services through a title grant. And then it was assumed by our agency in, I think, 2006 or 7. And then the funding for the federal component, I think, was rescinded in about 2009.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any other questions? So on your sheet, Dr. Rose, so the total, so I'm just trying to get your totals at the bottom. You have 38 staff and these 8 sites funded by this program, 485 different adults, and then 590 children out of these 136 families.
And yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Those are the most recent data we
families.
Have.
Yeah, okay. 360 families for biennium. Okay. Okay, any other questions? Representative Connolly.
Chair, Dr.
Mr. Chairman, our family literacy centers do a pretty good job of going into their communities, making families aware of these resources. We found that you don't use the conventional media, newspapers and radio ads, so they go to grocery stores and put flyers out. They put things on windshields. They also work with other agencies, state agencies and others to make sure that references and the availability of these programs can be made aware to the clientele that oftentimes are not typically accessing the normal ways that publicity for this kind of thing is done. So and in fact, one of our centers periodically goes from door to door, in places in communities where we know there's a significant component of this population.
Chair, and Dr. Rosen, is it true that a good number of these families are kind of English language learner families, so our immigrant population?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Connolly, depending on which center we're talking about, there's a number where there is a very high proportion of ELA, English language learners. In other cases, that's not so prevalent because just of the demography of the community, but there is a fairly high component of the adults who are needing to learn English in order to navigate the system, and so they are a significant portion of our population.
Other questions? Okay. Well, thank you. All right. Well, Steve?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ross, I just want to make one more comment about the early childhood funding. Chairman Harshman, you had asked about duplication, and our department has been tasked with ferreting out, I guess is the way to say that, ferreting out duplication within early childhood, and we're working hard on that, and I think we've done a good job so far, and we'll continue to do that. I know that one of the governor's charges to us as departments when he came into office in 2011 was to work together and not be nearly as siloed, and I would just like to point out to the committee that I think this is one of the best places for the where state government works together is in early childhood.
Well, have you been able, as a result of that, to cut or to ferret out duplication?
Chairman Ross, or Co-Chairman Ross, I'm not sure how we're doing this morning. All right, so Chairman Ross, sorry about that. I don't have specific examples, but I can tell you that duties, specific examples with regard to dollars, but I can tell you that I am not aware of any duplication of dollars in early childhood. The dollars that are state and the dollars that are federal are being used for very specific things, and I'm not aware of duplication currently in the departments. Very specific populations are being served by very specific dollars, and tasks have been doled out across the departments in very specific ways. So,
all right. Any other questions? Well, we appreciate you coming back. And
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just, if I may, I have a specific question on a but it's targeted at workforce services.
That's fine.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lisa, on the, if you could talk about the Wagner-Paisner grants and the impact. Now, I understand those grants support the workforce facilities around the state, and then the $500,000 cut to the Employment Services Division and the impact that has on the employment centers around the state, and kind of like a little outline of that grant and, you know, why the additional funds are needed.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hastert, thank you for the opportunity to explain that. The $500,000 proposed reduction in our budget is going to be very critical for the operation of our 23 workforce centers around the state. We will definitely see an impact if that goes through. The $500,000 is used to help supplement the Wagner-Paisner Fund that Senator Hastert referred to as federal dollars, and that is really the most visible dollars out in the state in our workforce center. Those are the dollars that help people who are laid off or looking for work to find employment. And the $500,000 basically, as I mentioned, it is to help those people find employment. And as you know, that the unemployment rate has significantly increased, specifically in some of the counties, Sweetwater, Natrona, Campbell, and Converse. And really those dollars are going to, that is going to negatively impact us being able to serve some of those communities.
Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
And then could you give the committee kind of an idea of how many people are served? And
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hastert, just as of recently, in the past year, and especially the counties that I just mentioned, the number of walk-ins have doubled, nearly doubled. And I think as some of the problems we're seeing, the clients who are walking in have much more significant barriers. And, for example, like a 60-year-old a minor laid off, he hasn't been looking for a job for many years, and so there's a lot more intensity in trying to help him find employment. He might need to do his resume again. He might need to help practice interview skills. So what we're seeing is not just the number of people coming in, but the level of service that is required. So, and again, these are Wagner-Paisner dollars, and over the past few years, about 8 years, we have seen a reduction in those federal dollars. And unfortunately, it's at a time when we're seeing more increased traffic. Mr. Chairman, Senator Hastert, did that answer your question?
Okay. I've been advised that you haven't had an opportunity to present. Is that correct?
No.
Have you already heard?
I'm Mr.
sorry,
Chairman.
I'm late to the meeting, but co-chair.
Well, Representative Connolly's request for the callback. I want to make sure that you've got everything you've.
Okay. Are you set? Okay. Well, we appreciate you coming back and helping us here. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we got next. We're up with the corrections. Director Lambert.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bob Lampert, Director of the Department of Corrections. There's basically two areas that I'd like to address. First of all, regards repair of the WSP and CAPCON, and I don't know whether to do that first or to talk about issues related to our regular budget first.
Let's talk about your budget first, and then we can talk about CAPCON.
With regard to WDOC's budget, there are several areas I'd like to mention as they were affected during budget markup. We are concerned that if the global cuts go forward along with the targeted cuts, it'll cause large problems. So I'd like to just mention those problems. I would like to remind the committee that the governor's recommendations reduced our standard budget by about 1% in general funds and 0.8% cut in tobacco funds, specifically $2.9 million in reductions as a result of governor's recommendations of general funds and $2.6 million in tobacco funds. So in addition to those cuts, the committee recommended an additional total reduction of $1.4 million in tobacco funds to help restore funding to the drug courts funded out of Department of Health. And I'd like to briefly explain what impact those additional cuts would have on the agency if they remain in place. First of all, the cuts in budget units 0442, 0452, and 0492 for a total of $620,766 in tobacco funds would reduce the funding for residential substance abuse programs, or the three residential substance abuse programs in the state, one at WMCI, one at the farm, and one at the Women's Center. The result of that would be to reduce the capacity of those residential programs by 17%. That just means that we wouldn't be able to serve 17% of the people that we're currently serving in terms of residential substance abuse treatment. The difficulty with that is that we would just have vacant beds in those residential treatment centers, and we need the beds. So, in effect, we would remove the funding so they wouldn't be able to be served, but we would just have vacant beds sitting in those residential settings. So that causes us some hesitancy. We can't house inmates that are in general population and therapeutic community and stay true to the treatment modality and achieve the results that we're currently receiving out of substance abuse treatment. And again, these are the highest risk individuals for future substance abuse using evidence-based programming prior to their release to reduce their risk of returning to substance abuse upon release. The cut of $400,000 in funding for community substance abuse treatment budget, Unit 2016, in effect eliminates the agency's ability to support drug court activity. That's where we pay for all the agents as far as their travel, all their supplies. It's also all the funding for the drug court testing of people that are involved in drug court and the funding for sanctions for drug court. All that funding comes in that unit 2016, and that removal of $400,000 in additional tobacco fund, in effect, means that we have drug courts, but we don't have any ability to support them. Finally, the cut of $400,000 funding for the Addicted Offender Accountability Act operation in budget 2020 would result in no funding for operations for AOAA. That's a statutorily required program.
What's that program? I mean,
basically what that program does is we're tasked with doing substance abuse assessments on all felony level criminals in the state, along with third offense DUIs. We do those assessments for the court. Those assessments are used in making decisions relative to sentencing. If we took that $400,000, that would eliminate all support for that program and would also require us to reduce our staff by two filled positions. So, as you may recall, last session we increased the number of assessors for the AOAA program in order to meet the court demands. This, in effect, would require us to have a reduction in force as well as remove all funding for support of that program. So that additional $1.4 million in tobacco funding is of extreme importance to the agency to move forward with statutory obligated duties. So we would ask at least consideration for restoration of that $1.4 million in tobacco funds. Our next concern is with the global 5% cut to 900 series contract services contracts. 22% of DOC's budget goes to contract services. We don't have programs in the sense that other agencies do necessarily. Instead, what we contract for are things like medical care for inmates, the substance abuse treatment, sex offender treatment, our adult community correction centers, our split sentences, our 100-bed facility in Casper. Those are our big 900 series contract. If we cut the funding for that, we're jeopardizing contracts for all those services. Our medical contract with a 5% reduction would reduce our medical budget to $38 million. Our contract itself is for $40 million. And we also have to pay 50% of all off-site medical expenses. So that would eliminate any ability to pay for those off-site services, put us out of contract, and basically we wouldn't be able to meet our constitutional obligation to provide medical care for inmates. The 5% cut to the 100-bed, again, would reduce the number of beds that we would be able to utilize in that program. I don't think it would jeopardize the contract itself. I think the 100-bed is fairly secure, even if the number of beds was reduced. However, again, those beds are essential not only to meeting the substance abuse treatment needs of the inmates under our charge, but actually just in having enough beds for the people that were charged with housing. And again, if the 5% cut carries through on ACCs and split sentencing, those are our primary alternatives to incarceration. We're asking actually for exception funding to increase those programs, so it's kind of counterintuitive to reduce it 5% and then grant exception request expansion. So we would suggest that the 5% global cuts for 900 series not be applied to the Department of Corrections. During budget markup, $5 million in vacant positions are targeted. Our average length of vacancy is 192 days. It was suggested the positions that have been vacant for more than 6 months be taken up until that $500 mark is reached. That is 42 correctional officer positions. If those positions were frozen rather than removed, we would still be able to get vacancy savings, but it would also allow us flexibility in terms of shifting those positions to WMCI when the build-out is complete in order to open those additional units for inmate housing. So we'd like to ask consideration for freezing those positions, coming back in the supplemental budget for permission to fill them and transfer them to WMCI upon completion of that build-out so that we can actually use the beds that we built.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Director Lampert, just to make sure that I'm understanding that what you're asking for there. So if we were to leave those positions in place, freeze them, and not fund them, and require you still to come back and request our approval in order to fund them and fill them, does that meet the needs that you have as we get the extra wing of the medium security prison up and open?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stupson, in effect, if we remove these positions, we'll have to come back and supplemental and ask for positions to open WMCI. I'm just trying to have to avoid asking for new positions in order to do that.
Yes.
Yes. So how many
positions do you anticipate after the new build out at in Torrington?
Mr. Chairman, we anticipate about 32 to 37 at WMCI, but we were also interested in shifting positions to WWC to allow that mother child program to open as well. So those 42 positions would cover both of those facilities in terms of the expansion or opening of those beds.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for our staff. How much was reverted in 15-16 from corrections? Was the initial shortfall, was it 15-16, then another? I got the number like it's $36 million in my head, but maybe that's too much.
Mr. Chairman, I believe it was $20 million, $15 million in January and $5 million in March of 2015.
So $20 million was reverted, and then our actions in JAC was to cut about $13 million. Is that right about?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's correct.
So, and then I think with our actions, though, I mean, we give this agency a lot of flex, not as maybe as much as the Department of Health, but then with our language where we go through and cut every line of the budget. So when you leave town, you know what's been cut. Let me just be clear about that. I think there was some confusion on that yesterday. Every line in the budget is cut. There's no confusion about that. But we did give the governor and the executive branch super flex, really, to go through. And if we need more money sex offender or addiction management, we could do that. I mean, so I guess I'm just trying to, Director, I hear we reverted $20 million, and we cut 13. So there's still $7 million that would suggest that we've overfunded the agency. And so I just, you know, and as we transfer these prisoners from Rawlins to this new pod we're building, and you talked about transferring, so I mean, it's going to be an ongoing project. It's not like we're not going to meet again. I mean, we're going to meet the needs of the state. I think we've done a really, we're trying to get these down to really what actual expenses are. I mean, in these constrained revenues. So my question on that, I guess, Mr. Chairman, is how the $20 million and that we've turned back in this budget fleshes out with the $13 million we cut. It seems like you'd still have $7 million there to really flex in your agency.
Mr. Chairman. We have been good stewards of the state's money and absolutely operated to our needs only, which has resulted in reversion. And we will continue to do that. However, we are a public safety entity, and we're only one emergency away from expending those dollars. For example, in the medical budget, we've spent, I think, about $600,000 in off-site medical expenses so far to date. But if we have an extreme situation, sometimes those can run several hundred thousand dollars each up. And so that flex has given us the ability to manage that. If we have any, for example, a need to shut down a facility, the Women's Center during the flood, for example, ability to manage that situation, we need some money to do that. Now, out of that money that was reverted, $14 million of that was vacancy savings. That's again because of our difficulty in recruiting positions, but that doesn't mean the positions aren't needed for accreditation, that they aren't needed for safe operations. It just means that we've had staff that have been working extremely hard and an extreme number of hours of overtime to keep our facility safe. That overtime comes at a premium, and it costs 1.5 times a staff position for every vacancy that we have to fill, or every position we have to fill with overtime. So it makes more sense to retain that flexibility to have those positions available to fill and reduce the overtime cost than it does to eliminate positions. When we look at the three primary areas of our institution, 65% of our 65% of our operational costs are tied to staff positions. That's where the most flex lies. 22% are for those contractual services I just mentioned. We pretty much tightened down to the contract level on those. There's no flex left, and the remaining 10 to 11%. Is for support services, the things that we can't do without. We have to feed inmates. We have to clothe inmates. We have to provide for all the things that have to happen in the institutions. We also have to keep our community safe in terms of providing for a certain level of supervision of our offenders in the community. We didn't expend all those funds to do so, but in response to the governor's request to trim our budget, we identified all those areas that we thought could be cut back without jeopardizing public safety and without a major reduction in force. So I guess my primary concern is if you take $5 million for staffing positions, if you take $500,000 out of sex offender money, if you take $1.4 million out of tobacco money, you know, 5% for travel, et cetera, and then ask for an additional 1.5% on top of that as a global cut, you know, all of our flexibility is gone, and we're going to have a serious discussion about a reduction in force in order to keep, I mean, the three ways that I can see to meet the overall demand is to, number one, close an entire facility and just say, you know, we're going to ship inmates out of state. We're going to absorb all those costs of doing so in terms of recidivism, in terms of impact to the inmates, impact to the family, impact to the host community, impact to state employees. That's one option. Another option is to say the only program that's left with any funding that could be eliminated but comes at a risk is elimination, complete elimination of a program we fought hard for, which is a sex offender program. There's an additional $2 million there. But 28% of our inmate population are sex offenders. That program's showing to have a 9%, or inmates that complete the program come back 9% less than inmates that don't complete the program or aren't involved in sex offender treatment. And those that have successfully completed the sex offender program have not had any, none of them have come back for a felony sex-related crime, whereas 55% of those who didn't get the treatment have come back for a sex-related crime. So we could eliminate the program, but there's a risk in terms of victimization. There's a risk in terms of impact to recidivism. Our only other programs we have remaining that don't allow for bed space per se is the rest of the substance abuse funding. And, you know, when we have 65% of our inmate population that has a moderate to high risk of future substance abuse, and we don't address those issues, all we're doing is turning back into our community people who need treatment. And if they don't get that treatment, they're going to return right back to their criminal ways. So besides housing and funding, housing and feeding, the only thing left is to try to reduce the rate of return to prison. And I'm seriously concerned that if we compound these cuts, we're not going to be able to meet our mandate to the citizens. So, Mr. Chairman, on paper it sounds like we don't use the money, don't need the money, but in effect we haven't used the money because we haven't been able to fill positions. And if we take those positions away, we're telling our existing staff, you're going to just have to continue to suck it up. There's no relief in sight. We're not concerned about you in terms of your long-term well-being. And I don't think that's the right answer to give to our state employees.
Mr. Chairman and Director Lampert, turning for a moment to the tobacco funding and the cuts that your budget took in that, you mentioned, I think it was around $400,000 that was reduced that went towards the drug testing for drug courts. And I'm a couple of questions. Just in looking at that tobacco funding, is there somewhere else that would be that you would see as more appropriate to get that $400,000 savings? That's sort of question one. And question two would be, would an approach to meeting those issues within the tobacco trust funding giving you, we've given you flex in the general fund side, but giving you some flex on the tobacco trust fund side on where to move those monies within your agency, would that help at least ameliorate some of the impacts of those cuts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stepson, the cuts that we offered up in the budget reduction through the governor's recommendation pretty much eliminated all traditional outpatient substance abuse treatment and all pretreatment and education. So we were left with funding for two types of treatment for the highest risk individuals, the intensive outpatient treatment and our residential treatment. Those were the two areas that we could have the most bang for the, you know, for the buck. The additional $1.4 million in cuts eliminates a large portion of that, or at least 17% of that residential piece. The only way to shift funding would be to eliminate funding from the intensive outpatient into residential, which there's a larger percentage of the population that has a need for intensive outpatient than residential. So we're, although we're addressing the highest need, we're also reducing the numbers of people served. Under the funding before any cuts, we were serving about 1,000 inmates a year in substance abuse treatment. That number will be reduced significantly with the $2.6 million cut in the governor's recs. That number will be cut closer to 400. And if we have to absorb these cuts, then we're talking closer to 200. So we've in effect reduced our ability to serve 800 of the inmates returning to our communities each year in substance abuse prior to their release.
And so, Mr. Chairman and Director Lampert, I take it from your answer then that you don't see flex within the Tobacco Trust Fund as really helping you in this circumstance.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. When we first learned of the potential for tobacco funding deficit, the primary agencies all got together. We, I guess you'd say, divvied up the pain, and then each agency determined where they would take those cuts. With the restoration of the drug court money, that pain is being shifted more to the Department of Corrections. But I think that the thing to remember is that pain is going to be, the burden is going to be on the communities, not on the state, in terms of if those individuals don't get treatment. So I guess if you look at pure numbers in terms of the people served, 65% of our inmates have a substance abuse treatment need. 28% of our sex offenders are 28% of our population are sex offenders. 40% of our population are mental health. So who can you serve the most? Well, it makes sense that you can serve more with substance abuse treatment. You can serve more with mental health treatment than you can in raw numbers for the funding for sex offenders. Again, I fought very hard for sex offender treatment money. I think it's a vital program. I think that it's made a large difference and saved some people from getting victimized. But if the question is, do we have to take obliterate sex substance abuse treatment or sex offender treatment in terms of raw numbers, substance abuse would seem to be the one to have the money for. And I don't know if that answers your question, but certainly not the answer I hope to give you.
I'm not sure I followed. You said substance abuse would be the
Mr. Chairman, in terms of impacting the most inmates, substance abuse treatment impacts more inmates.
Right.
In terms of victimization, that may not be the result.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
And I don't know if one of the things that occurred here, especially the Tobacco Trust Fund dollars, was a shifting of priorities from from the treatment of the folks that are already in prison to those that have the potential to go there with the drug courts. And so we're looking at how many are we preventing from even showing up at your doorstep and the savings associated with that and the treatment there. And that's a priority that we are looking at with those cuts. And so I don't know if you know what would be the impact if the drug courts go away. So, I mean, you've got a higher population, and then those costs within your organization grow as a result of the elimination of that program. I mean, we're trying to stop that problem up front.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly understand that. I've been on the drug court panel for the past 12 years in terms of the steering committee for that. So I'm very aware of the importance of drug courts. I'm very aware of the impact that they have on reducing people coming to prison. But I also know that drug courts can't absorb all the numbers of inmates that will be returned to the community if they're not treated. So I think it's a catch-22 in terms of, I didn't make the decision to cut the drug court funding. that wasn't my agency that made that decision ultimately. But I did make the decision that within the funding that we had available for substance abuse treatment, where we could get the largest impact in terms of future criminality. And I'm concerned that with those additional cuts, we won't be doing our share of the duty in terms of reducing that burden on people coming back to prison and committing new crimes. So I would urge consideration for restoration of that funding for the impact it would have on the Addictive Offender Accountability Act in terms of the drug court funding as well as residential treatment.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Director Lamport, so going back to the numbers that we talked about earlier, if you had reverted $20 million and we cut basically $13 million out of your budget, what's your plan on how you're going to spend that extra $7 million that otherwise would revert if things were wrong for the status quo? I mean, are you going to put those in those 44 employees you talked about? Are you going to put those into partially funding the drug and sex programs? What's your plan for that $7 million?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas, I would disagree that that's money that is unneeded in terms of investing it in things. How would I spend it? I would spend it as it's appropriated for. If it's appropriated for a vehicle, then it's going to be spent for a vehicle. If it's appropriated for whatever the appropriation is appropriate for is how I'm going to spend that money. That's the way that I see our budget. You'll see that we do move funds within our agency to cover shortfalls, but for example, overtime, we've had to shift some vacancy savings in order to pay for overtime. In terms of maintenance at the WSP, because we didn't have the staff to do the maintenance, we had to shift funding from elsewhere in support operations to cover the additional 900 series. So we spend it as it's allocated and appropriated, and if we have a shortfall, we address it within the agency first. And I don't know if that answers your question, but I guess I don't see it with the same lens in terms of that it's extra money. It's money that was.
Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on that same point, Bob, I mean, ultimately at the end of each budget cycle, you go back and you do your reconciliations to pull back where's the actual expenditures versus where was the budgeting. And when we come to that number, we end up with a $20 million number. So I guess the question, and this is obviously what we're struggling with, is how do you make those adjustments inside, because just as you talk about, that's not extra money. It was budgeted and we spent it appropriately. Nobody's arguing that you didn't do a great job. But when we come back and we look at our reconciliations, and we see that there are certain areas that were budgeted and certain areas that were budgeted and underspent, and there are certain areas that were budgeted and overspent, and you adjust your budgets accordingly, there's still, when it comes down to it, even before these things, there was $20 million. And where was that? And we're struggling with why is it that the $13 million that's cut here, it's not like it's just pulled back and not going somewhere. I mean, there's needs all over the state. So we're struggling with why is it the agency can't utilize or help us understand why the reconciliations that you guys go through don't help you identify those areas so we can shore up. Because obviously what we're trying to do is squeeze out every penny out of every agency that we can, but still allow you to complete your mission. And so help us understand why that's apparently improbable, if not impossible, to do.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Vice President, again, the bulk of our reversions are due to vacancy savings. Those, although we've tried very hard to recruit and retain positions, we haven't been as successful as I would have liked. Had we been successful, there certainly wouldn't have been nearly the amount of reversions that are available. I mean, out of the.
And thank you, but Bob, when we talk about that, I mean, what do we anticipate to change over the next 2 years? I mean, maybe with the downturn in the economy, maybe those jobs will start to be filled. I don't know, but you know, are you anticipating that there would be a change and so that we would be filling up these vacancies?
Mr. Chairman, we had approval to through Section 308 to spend $1.6 million to increase our recruiting efforts, and we're beginning to see the benefit of that in terms of an increase in the number of people coming into the agency. Certainly, if we don't have the positions to fill, we won't fill the positions, obviously. I guess what it all boils down to is I'm trying to explain that operationally, there's a huge risk if we cut operational funding, and if we cut contractually or constitutionally required contractual services beyond where we're at now, which is at the contract level. The only thing left is personnel positions. And I would rather see us target those positions in a way that allows for future operations, including new beds, than I would to take a risk on the immediate staff safety and constitutionality of our operations. So I guess I'm just trying to say that if you're gonna take money, then focus on positions, and we'll come back and ask for those positions as we need them. But that's going to send a message to our existing staff as well. And I just need you to understand that in terms of if I'm in a position and I've been promised, you know, hang in there, we're getting you some help, and all of a sudden that rug is pulled out from underneath them, that there's no help coming, we're going to lose some more staff. And I can see that. And I'm hoping that balance can be reached between meeting the needs of the state in terms of budget reduction, but also recognizing we have to give the existing employees some hope of relief, and we have to maintain our constitutional level of care, or, you know, one court case will more than wipe out any savings that we have. So I'm trying to maintain, you know, the best operation in terms of safe, secure, humane, and constitutional operation without fluff, and the only way to do that is target those positions. But I just think we need to balance that discussion and give our existing staff some hope along the way.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman, and so looking at your budget, when we look at your top priority, which is inmate medical care, and you've got there $42 million and change. Is that the amount of the contract?
Mr. Chairman, that's the amount of the contract, which is $40 million plus the $2 million or thereabouts that's for out of facility care for our 50% share.
Wait a second. Will you say that again? That's the what?
$40 million is for the contract, and then the additional is for that out of facility care that we're on the hook for 50%. That gives us that flexibility.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I know we're bumping in, but
I have a question with regards to the number of vacancies. It's not my understanding we didn't cut all of the vacancies. So after the cuts that we recommended, how many vacancies are still available for you to fill?
Mr. Chairman, there's approximately, I got the number here. Thank you. Off the top of my head, I think there's 210 total vacancies and about 171 of those in correctional series positions. So that's the total number of vacancies. The 42 positions that would be taken to meet the $5 million cut would come off of that. My concern is that then if you compound it with an additional 1.5% cut, that's an additional 35 positions. So you're eliminated basically 80 of those positions out of that total.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Are you saying that 1.5 million is comparable to 35 positions?
Can you repeat that, Mr. Chairman?
My understanding is that you just said that 35 mm-hmm. positions is comparable to a cut of $1.5 million.
Mr. Chairman, that's not correct.
1.5%.
1.5%.
Okay. And that 1.5% is how much?
About 4.2
million.
Million.
So with all of those cuts, Mr. Chairman, you still have over 100 vacancy positions that you can use then to use those funds to perform the ongoing operations, to fill positions and to fill the drug courts and to fill the sex offender courts.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, again, we don't have free flow 100 series flex like the Department of Health. We're limited to what you've given us in regards to currently that section 3.
Let's get this. If we gave you flex, would that solve the problem?
Mr. Chairman, that would assist, yes.
All right. So let's look at that as a committee. I mean, okay. I mean, I'm sorry to cut you off like that, but I mean, that seems like the logical solution is just give you some flex and you can use those positions because you still got over 100 position vacancies. Right?
Mr. Chairman, that would certainly help.
Okay. Yes.
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, Director Lampert, if there was flex, would you be able to in some way backfill those substance abuse programs and the sex offender programs?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Connolly, in terms of the substance abuse treatment, we would have to replace tobacco funds with general funds in order to make that work and mix the two, which we've done before and caused difficulty, which is why we shifted most of those programs, most of our tobacco funding specifically to those. But it could be done in terms of the sex offender treatment, the $500,000 targeted cut that was already taken. Again, assuming that we're talking compounding that with the other cuts, we wouldn't have to restore any sex offender treatment money. So that one's not impacted. The problem comes in the 5% 900 series because of the dollar amount, just to make us whole in terms of the contracts that we have in place. I don't think that flex authority would cover those shortfalls. So I would reiterate my request to be exempt from the 5% 900 series, global reduction for 900 series if we're going to make that work.
Okay. All right. I think we're running up against time constraints. We appreciate all your efforts, Bob. We know you do a good job. And yes.
I just have a different question. It's about the $13.1 million for the expansion of Torrington. What if we don't do that this year?
Mr. Chairman, if I can explain the Capcom situation in terms of WMCI and WSP, and I believe I may get to Representative Connolly's question.
You bet. I'm sorry.
You've all been forwarded a copy of my letter in regards to how to address what my recommendation to President Nicholas at his request was on how to address issues at WSP in terms of movement and elevation there and the subsequent damage. Without any mitigation, we may have a 5-year service out of that facility. And with the emphasis on the may, there are some areas of that institution that probably need addressed much quicker, including the electrical room and gymnasium areas of the facility. The lifespan of that could be a day, it could be a year, but it's certainly probably not 5 years because that's where the most significant movement is, and we have one primary electrical room serving that entire facility. If we lose that electrical room, we have no option but to close the facility, send inmates out of state until it's repaired. The cost of repairing or replacing that electrical room, the adjoining mechanical room, and repairing the gymnasium is $7,292,536. It's recommended that funding be available in FY17 to begin that process. In addition to that, the CPF and K-unit buildings are built on soil that's settling instead of elevating. And to fix that would be $4,118,000. That could be deferred for a year or so. But once we start into the inmate housing areas like K building or A, B, or C unit or any other units there, we're going to have a place to displace those inmates to during the construction. My recommendation in my letter was that we move forward with funding for the electrical room to address the short-term needs of the facility in terms of maintaining the facility. Proceed in FY18 with the repair of CPF and K units, which is the production facility for food and laundry as well as housing for the inmates to support those activities. In order to displace those 160 inmates without having to go out of state or without having to provide for temporary structure on site, which would be about $3.1 million to do that. If we had the facility at WMCI completed, we would be able to absorb any displacement from WSP internally and avoid any costs of out-of-state placement and potentially avoid any costs of temporary housing on-site as well. So
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Well, wouldn't if we do the medium security add-on and we transfer those inmates, what would be the point of replacing the space? I mean, I think we'd be putting good money after bad. Place is sinking in the ground.
Mr. Chairman or Mr. Co-Chair, we have 800 beds at WMCI. We're proposing 144 beds at Torrington. Our long-term projected needs, assuming that there's not a significant shift in public policy relative to incarceration in the state, is we're going to need those additional 144 beds by 2025 at the latest. So, in effect, what we're suggesting is that we repair at the lowest. It's less cost prohibitive to repair the existing facility at WSP and maintain 800 beds than it is to build a new facility, which is significantly more than double the cost per bed. So our recommendation, based on the Martin & Martin report, is that we repair WSP, that at the conclusion of repair at WSP, we keep two housing units in reserve, do not fill those, allow for the reduction in force at WSP to move forward until such time as we have to fill those beds. We'd already have the beds in reserve. We wouldn't have the staff for them, but would come back to the legislature. The shifting of the positions from WSP to WMCI would allow for the opening of that facility, and we would meet long-term needs as well, and with a 90% certainty, ensure another 30 years of service out of WSP in the existing beds.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
A couple questions. First of all, has this been taken to the State Building Commission? Where are they on this proposal that's in your letter?
Mr. Chairman, the State Building Commission is up to speed. If you may recall, in our exception request, we had asked for a $25 million placeholder, which was denied through the governor's recs.
The Martin Martin report hadn't all come back.
Correct.
When we had that last Building Commission meeting, it was still up in the air. So this is a little bit new information. They're up to speed on this?
They are, Mr. Chairman. Okay. The sticker shock total price for full repair at WSP is about $85
million.
But that can be phased over two bienniums. But there are some issues at WSP that I believe need to be addressed if we want to ensure both the short-term and long-term functionality of the facility. And that's why I suggested the $7.2 million for the electrical room in FY17 and the build-out of WMCI in 17 as well. The build-out period of time for WMCI is 15 months. If that CAPCON request that's in the bill is moved forward and made effective upon signature, we would, in effect, bring those beds online beginning of fiscal year 18 and have them available for any displacement.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
Mr. On the $7.2 million, that's electrical and a gym?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
What do those break out? What's the electrical?
It's all but $2 million of that is the electrical room area. The $2 million is to address the gymnasium area, and the primary reason that we need to address that is as that there's a long corridor that runs the length of the gymnasium that supports the roof of the gym, and that wall is beginning to move in a way that could jeopardize the structure itself. So we believe that needs to be addressed and as quickly as possible.
Yes, Senator.
That facility is what, 15 years old?
Mr. Chairman, I believe so.
Thereabouts. So we're gonna spend almost $7.3 million to mitigate the worst portions of it. I'm not that familiar with construction and mitigation and so forth, but has the ground stopped moving? I mean, is the mitigation going to take into account future movement on the part of the ground?
Mr. Chairman, the mitigation will. And I'm not trying to fix blame or, but I can tell you that based on the forensic review that we had conducted, when the facility was constructed, it wasn't constructed exactly to design in terms of that under each of the grade beams there was intended to be a void that would, as the soil swelled due to water, that void would absorb that swelling. However, there was a mud slab poured immediately under the grade beam and on top of the void form. So in effect, the soil is lifting on the grade beam and the void form isn't doing any good. So that they have to go in and excavate under the grade beams, and there's 4 miles of grade beams under the facility, and reestablish the void form. At the same time...
And that's what's covered in this $7.3 million? That's just that portion?
Just the gymnasium and the electrical and mechanical room, the primary...
And I guess the answer to my question, I guess you answered, is so the mitigation will be taking into account future ground movement?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Thank you.
Go ahead. I want to go back to one of your clauses early on, and it was something along the lines of subject to kind of continuation of public policy as it exists now. And so I don't have my notes with me from when you gave your presentation initially, but I remember that it's a different dollar amount per bed at the State Penn and the WCMI. But the most significant decrease was in alternatives to incarceration. And I'm curious if instead of thinking about marching down this path of we need to replace to maintain what we're doing now, the understanding is kind of we're talking all about men here in these cases, but men come in and out. Their sentences often are 5 years or less. And so if we do something at the front end instead of needing more beds, then we might not need these millions of dollars for facilities. So I'm curious if you can kind of back us up to some of those possible alternatives and the money that we would still need and the time frame.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Conley. As I stated during my budget testimony, we are a state that incarcerates at a rate that's in the middle of the pack, although we're the smallest state. That has resulted in a demand for prison beds, and we have a limited number of alternatives to incarceration, including adult community correction center placements, including split sentencing. And we've expanded those over time and taken some of the pressure off those prison beds. There's some legislation supported by sponsored by the Joint Judiciary Committee that will be considered this session that begins to address some of those issues in terms of providing some additional alternatives to incarceration. The total bill, as I recall, is either $5.2 million or $5.7 million for that. That would take the pressure off increases in the demand for increased beds. it wouldn't eliminate what we're currently getting in terms of the numbers of inmates. In order to do that, we would have to take a hard look at all of our criminal sanctions in regards to are we sending the right people to prison for the right length of time? And that's more than a three-minute discussion. But we have begun to look at the data in regards to that to find options that provide for public safety, hold offenders accountable, and reduce the overall costs of corrections. So with the partnership with the judiciary, we began to look at that, but that's not a immediate fix. As each of those pieces of legislation move forward, it's proactive in nature in terms of it'll address some of the future demand, but it won't address what's currently in place or will continue because of long sentences of people already in prison.
Don?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, the work on the electrical room and the gymnasium wall, am I correct to assume that's irrespective of the number of beds in the facility?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. If we don't have that electrical room, we don't have a facility.
Okay. Any further questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Mm-hmm. We got to get going here.
Well, keep going. Mr. Chairman, I have to go get my bill off my desk. So can we take 2 minutes?
2 minutes.
Which bill are we going to look at?
We got to start looking at Capcom.
Capcom bill?
On your desk are across the room on top of the bookcases behind the representative.
I left my bill.
Oh, okay. Very good.
Is the Don or...
Yeah.
There's no mouse.
Okay, Don and Don. We when we finished up yesterday, we were about halfway through, I think, or with on the capital construction bill.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the entire explanation was completed, and I believe that the next order was to begin to work the bill. Over the afternoon, I did want to bring to your attention, we do have a requested amendment to add at the, essentially a new Section 12. The committee already voted on this, and there was some discussion as to which bill it would be appropriate in. And we've circulated that amendment. This basically removes the matching requirement on the College of Engineering at the University of Wyoming. And you'll recall that was embedded in a governor's letter, which you approved, regarding the AML $10 million general fund swap.
Okay, and that's this amendment, folks, that you should have on your desk. Okay. It's amendment to 16 LSO 0... 350.1.2, and it's Section 12. Okay? So that we'll need to incorporate as we work the bill. So, did we have a motion on the bill yesterday?
I don't think so. Move the bill, Mr. Chairman.
It's been moved by the co-chair. Is there a second? Okay. All right. So we're now at that point where we can start consideration of the of the bill. Is there any public comment on the bill before we begin to work the bill? Hearing none. Let's work the bill, and I'll close off public comment. So what I would suggest is, are there any amendments? Let's just kind of thumb through. Are there any amendments? Page 1, 2, 3.
I think, Mr. Chairman, on page 4, and I just think, and I don't know that we need to decide at this moment. We're not going to finish this in the next half hour, so I don't think we're going to take a final vote on. But, Don, I just want to make sure we all are aware that this language on 18 and how that ties into, I mean, really none of these projects are going to move until those funds have been, everything has moved, till the funds are available, frankly. And that's page 4, line 17. That's not where it kind of gets put into action, but that's the definition, correct? And I guess when we get to that point, and where is that at, actually, where that?
Mr. Chairman, that is on page 8, beginning on line 9. And it basically says that except as provided in paragraph 2, general funds appropriated shall only be released when those conditions are met. And the conditions, you were correct, Mr. Chairman, began on the bottom of page 4 with the definition of unappropriated, unobligated, and unrestricted federal funds. So it basically indicates that the projects in Section 3 from the general fund, which include the forestry, the two community college facilities, the Casper facility, the health facility, and all but the $10 million of the engineering building of UW's request would be contingent upon the receipt of federal funds, the expenditure of those funds, and the reimbursement of those funds.
Right. Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, just so I'm clear on that, so then we're looking at, before any contracts can be let, then you're looking at, what, June of 17? Is that what we're saying?
In my opinion, would be the start of a few of them, depending on the prioritization of the list.
Well, okay, I still don't understand what you just said.
I don't think in 17 it'll all be fully realized, unobligated funds. I think it'd be more towards the end of the biennium until it's fully done. I think we'd be partially done in a year, is my guess. I mean, I don't, maybe staff can.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct. There's roughly $168 million, and that will not all be spent in the first month or even in the first year. It will probably come in over the course of the full biennium, maybe extending to the next biennium. So these funds would go, and that's what is so important about the priority list. These funds would move as those funds are available. So you might have, say, $80 million in the first year and $80 million in the second year.
So, Mr. Chairman, we need to look at that priority list, and then maybe also, in particular, with the healthcare facilities, is break that down into smaller components. Is that what I'm hearing?
I think you could, or I think there's other options, too, how you guarantee and pay back and those kind of things to allow contracting. And, I mean, we did similar thing, really, with the Capitol building. And
so, Mr. Chair.
Through the reserve account. So.
In that regard, what do we know realistically, what's in the pipeline through the Department of Transportation in terms of that's there, that's going to be constructed, that's going to be expenditures that are going to match that follow through?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, the funding you have provided in the AML bill to the Wyoming Department of Transportation is essentially their entire state-funded biennial appropriation. So it would occur over the course of 17 and 18, fiscal year 17 and fiscal year 18.
And, Mr. Chairman, I don't think we're going to need to probably work on this for the next half hour and try to solve this. I just want people to be aware of it and think about it. There's probably four or five ways to solve it. And one way is to just leave it the way it is. But I just wanted the committee to be aware of it. So I don't want to hold up working the bill on this.
Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don, when do we expect the check to be in the mail from the feds?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Connolly, it's important to keep in mind this is all on a reimbursement basis. So, for example, a road must be built. It must be fully constructed. The invoice must be submitted to the Department of Transportation, then to the Department of Environmental Quality, then to the Department of Interior in Washington. That process takes about maybe 3 weeks to a month after the completion of the project.
Okay. All right. So any further questions on four?
Okay. Sorry. Go ahead. I just want us to be aware. I mean, that's a big issue.
Yeah, it is. And so then we get over here to Section 3, and which begins on page 5 and then goes over into pages 6 and 7.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment on page 6.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I am going to move to delete line 17, 18, 19, and 20, and on the general fund side of that. And, Mr. Chairman, if I'll get a second, I'll discuss it.
You're going to delete them?
Is there a second?
Is there a second?
Second. Never mind.
Is there a second? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and then I'm going to also include on that page or line one on page 7. And, Mr. Chairman, these are, I fully supported all of these, and I think it's important that we do capital construction. And in light of some of the modifications, you know, my personal priorities have changed. And if it's, an option of funding buildings or, people losing their jobs, I think we can fully fund K-12. If we make some of these cuts and early childhood education, we don't have to cut services to senior citizens. So, Mr. Chairman, if I have to pick between people and buildings, I have to go. My values are that I can't personally, at this point, support these buildings. Like I said, I think these are all great projects, and I have fully supported them in the past. And at this time, I just can't support these.
So let me be clear. Your motion is to delete lines 17, 18, 19, and 20, and line 1 on page 7.
That's correct. That's my first motion, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I'd urge the committee to reject the motion. I think we heard some of these kind of comparisons, I guess you'd call them, in the speech yesterday. I think I'm not sure who we think resides in the state mental hospital. I mean, I think there are people in the state mental hospital. I think there are people in Lander in 100-year-old buildings. I think there's 11 million of people that are Title 25 commitments that we don't know what we're going to do with. And so we can sit and kind of make comparisons that don't really matter. We know, serving on this committee, that you want to try to, I mean, to try to compare those things is a false comparison. And there's also other people out in Wyoming who actually are working on these projects. And I'd remind the committee, there hadn't been one government employee lose their job in this budget. Okay? And there hadn't been one government employee rifted in this budget. These are all vacant positions. And I think we've discovered two that were, in fact, filled, and we're going to go back, I'm sure, as a committee and correct that. But there are people who build these facilities, and there are our most vulnerable citizens actually inhabit these facilities. And so that's a false argument. It's all about people. That's what we do. And I don't want to bog this committee down with that. And with all due respect, Senator Hastert, I'm just not buying that. I'm so over that. And I think to take these one-time funds, they're going to be one time, and then what's going to happen in 2 years from now? So we spent our one-time funds on whatever to prevent a maybe 3% cut on the general fund side of the budget. Then what do you do? And what about the people who are in these old facilities at our state mental hospital and our state training school? So, you know, again, it's not about, I don't think, again, with all due respect to all the committee, this deal is not about optics or what we think or trying to describe optics, how things look. It's really about doing the right thing. And I know we're going to debate that, but I think as this committee provides the leadership on this budget, I just think it's I'm just going to push back on that. So that's where I'm at. And I urge a no vote on the amendment.
Any further discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I'm going to speak against that amendment as well. And I'd like to see what we're looking at. Whether some of those projects are appropriate or the amounts are right now are yet to be debated. But I think what this body's done is looked at taking what is the ongoing cost to government, comparing that with the ongoing revenues. And what we're looking at right here are using some one-time funds that have shown up. And I'm going to submit to you that my folks in Washakie County understand the difference between ongoing costs and one-time revenues and what you do with that. They're smart enough to do that. It's what they do their entire life. They know that their ongoing operations, their ongoing costs got to match their expected revenues. And then when something comes in, a bonus or an extra payment or something, a windfall hits them, they use that for investment. And that's how we've been able to prosper. And I know my folks are smart enough to understand that, and I must stand behind them. So I'm going to resist this motion.
Any further? Yes, Representative Conlon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm in favor of this motion. And with all due respect to my good colleague from the middle of the state, I mean, windfalls can be and should be used for programs, for taking, you know, whether it's taking care of your health care needs, paying for whatever. I mean, that's an alternative to fixing your roof or building a new building. And in all honesty, we've got five bills going forward in this budget session, and I think it would be most prudent and fiscally responsible that we delay these buildings by at least a year. We come back in the supplemental session and say, if we have the money next year, after everything falls out from this year as well as a new Craig, that's when it makes sense to do some new construction. But until then, I think our priorities should be with the general operations of the state and those other budget bills that we have and not here.
Okay. Thank you. Question on the motion?
Yes. I will go to the... agree and to say to the all due respect to the committee and Mr. Kocher on that also. And you know, when you talk about ongoing funds, these are general funds, and they're coming out of general fund, so they're coming out of a place where it's ongoing funds, Mr. Chairman. And then you know, the way, and unless I'm reading the sheet wrong, that family literacy program employs 38 people, and we've cut it completely. And so that's, in my mind, there's 38 jobs that are gone. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am certainly sensitive to construction jobs. I mean, I have supported construction jobs, and this is by no means an easy type of motion to make. I mean, it has ramifications on either side of it. We have a tremendous amount of issues in this state, and as far as you know, it's just, it comes to, you know, there are the potentials for people losing jobs, but then there's construction jobs too. You know, those are all valid points, Mr. Chairman, and I just feel like that I have to just, I'm just simply making the choice on this on the buildings, and that's where it comes from.
Okay, question on the question amendment. On the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. No.
That motion has failed.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I do have another motion just on pages 6 and 7.
Your mic.
Yeah, it is. Hello. I would move on the top line 1, page 7, to move Department of Health facilities up in priority to number 3. So right in front of the CCCWC Ag Animal Science Building.
Second. So you're going to move it in?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just a point of clarification. On page 8 and 9 is actually the listing of the priorities. I mean, I understand the gist of your...
8 and 9?
Yeah, on pages 8 and 9, letters A through H are the priorities in order that they appeared in the request.
Let me ask you a question, if I may. So when you start looking at, you know, on pages 6 and 7, which is the easy way to look at it, you know, when you get to, like, CC, Ag and Animal Science, those are other funds, and all the way down. Those are not impacted one way or the other by a potential transfer of AML funds. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
All right. So they will happen regardless. And so what I think we're trying to figure out is what are the kind of general fund priorities. I just want to make that clear. Okay. So at this point in time, then I guess the amendment would be to move the Department of Health facilities up in the priority list, so that it would fall behind forestry and ANI, FACS, Casper. Is that correct? Is that correct, Tim?
Yeah, that was correct. It was move that up to number 3, Mr. Chairman. But I would move. I'd like to amend that to move that to our number 1 priority.
Second.
I'll consider that a friendly amendment.
Huh?
That's a friendly amendment.
All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
Don, is there any practical effect or difference in terms of priority on these?
Mr. Chairman, there is, and it's a significant effect. It means that the first $70 million, which, roughly speaking, a year's worth of payments, would go toward the health facilities under the amendment. The ramifications of that are all subsequent facilities, forestry building, community college facilities, would be behind that first $70 million. So they would essentially be set back 1 year under the current language.
So we have a...
Oh, wait a minute. I think we're getting a more complete answer. So, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
So, Don, if I'm understanding what you're saying, by moving the health facilities, moving lines, page 7, line 1, up to the number 1 priority, which is the amendment, as I understand it, you're delaying all the other projects by 1 year? Is that what you just said?
It'll take about a year for the health facilities to be fully funded, and then they would take the next project and then the next project. So, yes, it would have the impact of delaying, at least under the current language. And I believe the co-chairman mentioned there's three or four different ways to address this. For example, you could have a interfund loan or something to guarantee that those resources are available. But as the currently written, you're exactly correct. It would delay it 1 year.
Mr. Chairman, with the exception being that a number of these are just authorization only. And so it's not going to have any effect on the ones that are other fund authorizations, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, correct. So lines 21 through 26 have no impact in the priority list. It's only related to those with general funds.
So, Mr. Chairman, so I understand this thoroughly. It's going to take the Department of Health or that $70 million, it's going to take over a year or about a year to raise that amount of money anyway. Is that what I just heard you say?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Of the amount that we know is coming in to the state, to the Department of Transportation, it's $168 million. So roughly $80 million per year. So it will take about a year. Assuming, you know, it's evenly split between both years of the biennium, it'll take about a year to fill up sufficient funds appropriated in this bill for the health facilities.
So, Mr. Chairman, as I understand the explanation, if we reject this amendment, these other projects, line 17 through 20, will get funded within this next year as they fill up. They can finish their projects, and the health facilities are going to take a year anyway. Is that what? Am I hearing that? That's the understanding I have from your explanation,
Mr. Chairman. Under the current language of the bill, prior to the amendment, the forestry level 3 could probably start in hypothetically September of this year. And then it would take, again, 3, 4, 5 months to fill up the CASPER one. Then you're looking at maybe January for the CCCWC. It would be staged. And I'm being pretty generous with the months. But, you know, sometime next spring, the Northwest or Northern Wyoming Community College would have its funding available. Something like that. Keep in mind also, just a point of clarification, that UW is at the end of the list just because of the way the priorities are listed in the bill.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, based on that timing, I would vote against this amendment, and not that I'm against the Department of Health facilities. I'm as much for those as anybody else here, but I don't see any reason to hold up everything else when, in fact, the Department of Health facilities are going to take that amount of time anyway. Plus, you're talking about having to go through the planning and engineering and so forth for those facilities. These other facilities are already, they're basically shovel ready. They're ready to go. And the idea of holding them back for a year while the money is accumulating for the one big kahuna doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Mr. Chairman, I think actually the timing is just right under this motion, because really what you're looking at is the level 3 planning over the next year, which would be anticipated to be completed in about a year's time frame. And so what you see at the end of that year is you've got the design in place and you've got the money in hand and you can move forward. And remember, this isn't the full health facilities bill. There's a $149 million bill on this project. So this is a phase one of that project.
Yeah,
and so if you don't do it this way, what you do is you design, you plan for a year, and then you wait another year before you can break ground on these health facilities projects. And that's what I don't want to see happen.
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding, is we're talking about two different health facilities, and one we don't even have the funding. We don't even have the funding planned yet. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct, Mr. Chairman. They are two facilities, but the design and construction and implementation
are both within that $70 million.
Integrates the two facilities, and frankly, the level 3 will spell out how that gets phased and whether it's across both those facilities, whether it's one of those facilities. We don't know that yet, And so it may be construction at just one. It may be construction at both of them. We don't know that yet.
And, Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, I think we have a little over 35 or 36 million currently. And the one project is rough. They're about 50-50. So if we build one, it's going to be 70 million and the other one's going to be 70 million. There's a little, one's a little bit more expensive than the other. And so with this 70 million plus the 35 million we have, we're about 105. So we're going to need another 40 or 45 under current estimates to finish off both programs. And that's just the lay of the land to know where it's coming from.
And Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding is if we don't get on this, just as Representative Stubson had said, so we're ready in a year when this is ready to go. You'd think that this facility also ties in with the plans to help reduce that ongoing bill for the Title 25. I mean, I see this as the highest priority for us to get to. That's the reason I asked to move that up.
Mr. Chair, I would move to amend the motion, and instead of making it $70 million, I would make it $45 million. Because that would allow sufficient funds to at least start and fully implement the state hospital because there's a priority amongst the two. If you can't build them both at once, and unless we're going to fund it for $100 million instead of $70 million, we might as well get it done and get the construction done up and running and bid out, I think, the state hospital. And there's already funds set aside to do that level three, and we can do that instantly. You know, that'll happen shortly after the session is over. That will leave at least $75 million to complete the Wyoming State Hospital, and so we can break it up into sections. And to me, that just makes the most sense instead of doing the whole thing all at once.
Is there a second to that?
Second.
Okay. Discussion?
Mr. Chairman, just a clarification question to the sponsor on that. The $45 million is for this biennium or the first fiscal year?
Okay. What did you say?
You said first fiscal year.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just and we're on the amendment to the amendment.
Right.
To reduce that 70 to 45. Yeah, and I think I'm going to vote against that amendment to the amendment. Just I think when you talk about terms of fiscal years and bienniums, we really don't know that. I think it's just an attempt to try to get these projects paid for with one-time funds in this budget. And it might even, before the receipt of all these funds, might even carry over to the next budget before it's done. And we can't control all that. But I think it's just the attempt in this bill is all of these projects to be fully funded in this budget. And if we start, if you do that, then you got to have a plan for the rest of that and the rest of these projects, or you're going to run out of time and run out of money, frankly. And so I just think this health facility thing is just too important, and I think it's probably our number one priority. And so I'm going to vote against that because I think it casts the whole thing into a whole kind of uncertainty.
Don, did you have something to say?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted a clarification. Are you reducing the 70 to 45, which would essentially reduce $25 million, or are you splitting it 45 at priority number one and 25 at priority number seven?
Oh. Okay. Total different motion.
Yeah.
That sounds
nice
like it's
recovery.
Only...
Nice recovery, Bob.
That almost sounds friendly.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So as I understand it then, that would put, I assume that the state hospital, I think that's the first priority of the two. That would put that up number one. It would include the rest of these facilities so they could get their funding down and get their facilities built. And also provide planning and everything needed for the Life Resource Center, but we still then have to come up at some point with more funding for them.
That's correct.
All right, Mr. Chairman, I'll speak in favor of that amendment. Well, I already have actually. Never mind.
Okay. So this is the amendment to the motion. And we'll take a vote on that unless there's further discussion. All those in favor of the amendment to the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? That's been adopted. Now we're back on the basic motion, which was to move Department of Health on up to priority number one.
45 minutes.
Well, as amended, 45 up to. Do you got that, Don?
Yeah.
45 million up to number one. Any discussion? All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion's been carried. All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'd like to make a motion, but a question for staff first.
Okay.
Do you know the balance you on? I'm on page 7, line 2. Do you know what, without 13.5, what the balance is in that permanent land fund?
It's like 7 million or something.
I believe, Mr. Chairman, that's my recollection is about 7 million.
I think that was about this right here. It's,
oh.
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's on page 4 of that letter from the
7.2 million.
$7,292,536.28. No, I'm kidding about the 28 cents, but.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, my notion would be to add to this bill authorization to go ahead with the repairs to the electrical facility and the gymnasium wall at WSP and for $7 million to come out of that permanent land fund.
There's $7 million.
Second.
Okay. Discussion. So we're going to deplete the penitentiary permanent land fund or whatever it is.
Mr. Right. Chairman?
Yeah.
If I might... Can staff tell us the refill rate on that? I mean, that refills a little bit each year, I know.
Mr. Chairman, it's a pretty slow refill. The reason it's at 21 million or 21.8 million now is you've actually had some general fund appropriations to that account back a decade or so. So it's a pretty couple million dollars-ish.
So that, Chairman?
Yes.
I'd like to amend the amendment to reduce that to $5 million, which was referenced to be the electrical fix to the facility.
Okay. Is there a second to that? Okay. So any discussion?
Oh, Mr. Vice President. Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess a question for Representative Burkhart. I mean... But, I mean, the other issue in there was $7.3 million, which was we've now got that motion. But the other issue that they were talking about was the number three party, which is the other. There was another $4.1 million that had to do with the cost to remediate the K unit building, and you're intentionally excluding that.
Mr. Chairman, at this time, that would be the most critical need is for that electrical room, and without the electrical room, you don't have security and that sort of thing. And, you know, frankly, a little selfish. I don't want the inmates showing up on my doorstep.
Right. So we have a motion. We have an amendment to the motion, which is $5 million.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
If I could, and I guess I could.
We're going to need to go.
So yeah.
Take
if
a vote on
Mr.
This
Lampert's still here. I'm just wondering, is it? You're going to bring in a construction company that's going to do this for the electrical room and put the void and all that stuff in there. If we are only doing it for the electrical room and they're not staying there to finish up the gym, does that cost more? Was that calculated in as two separate costs, or was that calculated in as one project?
Director Lampert.
Mr. Chairman, the $7.3 million contemplates them staying on site and doing that. If they have to move off site and then return, there would be a premium for that.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, based on that answer, I'm going to vote against this amendment. If they're going to be there anyway, let's get her done.
All right, so we have the amendment to the motion, which was to take it to 5. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
That's failed. We still have the underlying motion, which is the 7 million for the remediation of the electrical room problem and the wall in the gym. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
That motion has been adopted. We're going to have to cut it off at this point in time, folks. So we have to gavel in. We'll come back upon noon recess and continue to work the capital construction bill. So thank you.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Are we going to be here?
I think we're going to be here. Is that correct? Have they fixed the leak yet? All right.
We're probably going to be here.
We're here then.